He built an empire on rhythm, fashion, and fame. But behind the diamond watches and private jets, Sean Diddy Combs allegedly engineered something far more sinister. A psychological ecosystem of control, coercion, and silence. From luxury apartments used as leverage to surveillance tapes that blurred the line between intimacy and blackmail. This is the true story of manipulation at the highest level. Told by a veteran female investigative journalist, this isn't gossip. This is a case study in how love becomes a weapon, silence becomes a shield, and power protects itself. Until it doesn't. The trial isn't over, but the illusion is. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Behind the velvet curtain. I've been a journalist for nearly 15 years. I've covered political scandals, corporate takedowns, and cult trials that rattled the system. But the Sean Diddy Combs case? It feels different. Not because of the headlines, but because of the structure. The system he allegedly built around himself, the women drawn into it, and the silence that lasted for decades. What we're dealing with here is not just a celebrity sex scandal. It's a manipulation ecosystem. One fueled by money, reinforced through surveillance, and protected by fame. To understand how we got here, you have to go back. Not to the first accusation, but to the pattern. Because this wasn't an isolated incident. This was architecture. And it started long before the world was ready to see it. The introduction of power. Sean Combs built an empire. From Bad Boy Records to Ciroc Vodka to fashion to media, he became a symbol of modern black wealth and cultural dominance. He was confident, magnetic, powerful. And with power comes access. Access to people, to places, to privacy. Access to women who saw him as a gateway to safety, opportunity, or love. But power, unchecked, becomes something else. It becomes manipulation in motion. Cassie Ventura was 19 when she met him. He was 37. The age gap wasn't the issue. The imbalance of power was. Within months, she had signed to his label, moved into his world, and, as her civil lawsuit would later reveal, became emotionally, physically, and psychologically dependent on him. She alleges he dictated what she wore, who she could speak to, where she went. Surveillance wasn't subtle. It was built in. She was allegedly followed, watched, recorded. For her, the line between relationship and captivity blurred fast. She's not alone. Pattern recognition. Over the years, multiple women, ex-girlfriends, employees, and industry insiders would describe a similar experience, an invitation into Diddy's orbit. Lavish gifts and promises of career opportunities. Sudden emotional dependency. Control tactics. Monitoring, verbal coercion, financial manipulation. Isolation from friends and family. Introduction to sex rituals described as freak-offs. One woman, testifying under the name Jane, claimed she was invited into an intimate relationship with Combs around 2021. It started like most, charm, seduction, generosity. But within months, she says she was being coerced into filmed sex acts, drug-fueled group encounters, and humiliation. He paid for her apartment. That support became leverage. She claims the rent was threatened when she resisted his demands. This is a psychological method called compliance reinforcement, where emotional and material rewards are tied to obedience, not affection. She says she felt trapped, dependent, obligated, controlled. Not just love, a system. Manipulation at this level is an emotional impulse. It's intentional engineering. Diddy didn't just manipulate women. He allegedly manipulated the environment around them. Employees, handlers, travel coordinators, security. All pieces in a larger strategy of access, isolation, and image protection. Capricorn Clark, a former employee, testified she was taken at gunpoint, interrogated, and warned not to reveal internal activities. She described a workplace where fear and obedience were expected, and loyalty was extracted through threat, not trust. This is important, because manipulation doesn't survive in isolation. It needs support. It needs enablers. And if the allegations are true, that's exactly what existed. A structure of silence upheld by careers, NDAs, and money. Why this went unnoticed? You may ask, how did this last for over two decades? The answer is unsettling. Fame protects. Wealth distracts. And when a man is seen as a cultural icon, his narrative controls the room. Accusers are disbelieved. reports are buried. Victims stay silent. Media outlets hesitate. Corporate partners look the other way. In psychological terms, this is called institutional reinforcement, where systems validate and preserve power, even in the face of credible allegations. Cassie's 2023 lawsuit was the first public fracture. She alleged physical abuse, forced sex with male prostitutes while Combs watched, and threats of retaliation. He settled, within 24 hours, for a reported $20 million. That wasn't a denial. It was damage control, the mechanics of fear. Fear doesn't always come as shouting or bruises. In this case, it came through control of housing, through constant filming, through selective affection, through public humiliation disguised as lifestyle choices. Jane said she researched the word cuck to better understand what he wanted, because he didn't explain. He demanded. She complied. Not because she wanted to, but because she feared what would happen if she didn't. This isn't about sexual preference. It's about coercive expectation. And when expectations are laced with fear, the line between yes and no disappears. What this means? We are watching a federal trial unfold that alleges sex trafficking, racketeering, coercion, and abuse. The charges aren't symbolic. They are systemic. Diddy stands accused not just of harming women, but of building an enterprise designed to control, silence, and exploit. As a journalist, my role is not to speculate guilt or innocence. But when multiple women describe near-identical patterns across years, when trauma aligns with timelines, behaviors, and internal documents, the story becomes clearer. This isn't about scandal. This is about structure. This is about manipulation at scale. The mechanics of control. Control is rarely loud. It's not always a slap. Sometimes it's a look, a missed rent payment, a silence that means, you know what happens if you say no. Chapter 2 begins with that silence. Because at the center of this case is not just abuse, but a methodology, a deliberate, repeatable system designed to bend consent until it shatters. The prosecution calls it trafficking. The survivors call it survival. But beneath the legal definitions lies something more subtle. A structure built not just to obtain sex, but to manipulate the psychological conditions in which yes becomes meaningless. The freak-offs. The first time I heard the term, it sounded cartoonish. Freak-offs. But when Jane took the stand and described what they were, the courtroom fell silent. These were not parties. They were rituals. Orchestrated, scheduled, incentivized. Jane described arriving at hotels with no idea who would be waiting inside. She says Diddy would text or call her with instructions. Sometimes gently, sometimes aggressively. There would be drugs. Ecstasy, Molly, weed. She says she rarely took them willingly. Most times, she didn't know exactly what she was taking. Then the filming would begin. Multiple witnesses, including employees, testified that these encounters were often recorded. Whether on phones or security-style equipment, the camera was always part of the room, always watching. The participants? Strangers. Escorts. Occasionally other celebrities or staff. The intent? Power. This was not about pleasure. It was about documentation, leverage, and control. Financial strings attached. Jane lived in a luxury apartment in Los Angeles. Her rent, over $10,000 a month, was paid directly by Sean Combs. But that apartment wasn't a gift. It was a collar. In her testimony, Jane said, "He told me if I ever disrespected him again, the apartment was gone. My son and I would be out on the street." This wasn't metaphorical. She had no job, no separate income. Her housing, utilities, even the security guards in the lobby were tied to his payroll. In psychological terms, this is a dependency trap. When a victim's basic needs, shelter, food, healthcare, are controlled by the abuser, the victim becomes emotionally and logistically paralyzed. Leaving becomes unthinkable. Not because the love is strong, but because the cost of independence is higher than the pain of staying. It's manipulation through circumstance. Consent under duress. A defense attorney may ask, "Did you agree to these acts?" And in some cases, Jane or Cassie or Capricorn may say, "Yes, but consent under duress is not real consent." If a woman is told she'll be homeless unless she complies, if a woman is threatened with public humiliation via leaked tapes, if a woman is drugged, isolated, emotionally blackmailed, and then told to perform, that is not a choice. That is survival. When Jane was asked in court why she didn't leave sooner, she said, because I didn't know who I'd be without him. He made me feel like I was nothing unless I did what he wanted. That is textbook coercive manipulation. Sex is currency. Diddy didn't just demand sex. According to testimonies, he orchestrated sex between others, often watching, filming, or directing from a distance. In Cassie's lawsuit, she alleged that she was forced to sleep with male prostitutes while Combs observed, directed, and sometimes filmed. These were not consensual threesomes. These were assignments. That pattern appears again with Jane, who said she was required to perform sex acts with other women while Diddy watched. Sometimes calmly, sometimes recording, sometimes threatening to post the footage if she failed to perform right. This wasn't intimacy. This was ritualized humiliation. Survivors say the acts escalated. Boundaries were pushed gradually. And every violation was followed by a reward, a gift, a trip, an apology, a classic trauma bonding cycle. This is how control is tightened over time. Drugs and memory. One chilling theme that surfaced repeatedly in testimony: memory gaps. Several women described being given pills or drinks that altered their perception, made them compliant, and then waking up unsure of what happened. Some remembered flashes. Others remembered pain. Others remembered video evidence shown to them after the fact, with their own body on screen, doing things they didn't remember consenting to. This raises questions not only of consent, but of intentional incapacitation, a criminal act when used to exploit or record a person sexually. One woman described feeling like a doll in a room full of shadows. She said she saw herself on screen after the fact and didn't recognize the version of herself in the footage. What is more psychologically violating than seeing your body behave in ways your mind never agreed to? The camera as a cage. In every room, there was a camera. In the hallway. On the dresser. In Diddy's hand. Cassie said she once refused to have sex on camera and was screamed at until she gave in. Jane said she was beaten for looking disinterested in a recording. Another woman said she was told the videos were for his private collection, but found out later they were shown to friends and associates. This is surveillance as manipulation, where privacy is removed, consent is erased, and your body becomes a product. These tapes were not kept out of nostalgia. They were a threat, a file, a weapon, and that's the pattern. Diddy didn't need to shout. He had leverage. He had evidence. He had control. The luxury lie. From the outside, it looked like opulence. Luxury cars. Diamond necklaces. Champagne. But to the women inside that world, it felt like a contract signed in silence. They were expected to look happy, behave obediently, and never contradict the image. Some said they were told to smile for paparazzi immediately after being assaulted. Others said they were forced to post loving photos online, while their phones were being monitored for messages they weren't allowed to send. They weren't just being manipulated. They were being scripted. The perfect girlfriend. The loyal assistant. The cool ex. These roles weren't earned. They were assigned. And stepping out of them came with consequences. Psychological costs. When manipulation is sustained long enough, the victim begins to internalize it. Multiple women testified that they began to question their own memories. They wondered if they were the problem. If they were crazy. If they were broken. This is known as gaslighting, the psychological technique of distorting a person's perception of reality until they no longer trust themselves. For years, they didn't report, not because they weren't hurt, but because they thought no one would believe them, or worse, that their pain wasn't valid. That is the deepest level of manipulation, when you no longer need the abuser to control you because you've absorbed the control. The legal consequences. As of now, Sean Combs is facing allegations that include sex trafficking, racketeering, obstruction, coercive control, witness intimidation, and more may come. Federal agents are investigating money trails, employee testimonies, and digital records from devices seized during raids in Los Angeles and Miami. The trial is ongoing, but the stories are clear. This isn't just a question of what happened. It's a question of how it kept happening. Because manipulation, when left unchecked, doesn't just break people. It builds empires. Surveillance, shame, and submission. Power doesn't always shout. Sometimes it watches. It records. It archives. In Chapter 3, we turn to the camera, a tool Sean Diddy Combs allegedly used not for memories, but for manipulation. What emerged in courtroom testimony wasn't a man using surveillance for security. It was a man allegedly using cameras as cages, capturing consentless sex, fear, and humiliation, and repurposing it all as a tool of psychological warfare. This wasn't voyeurism. It was systemic documentation designed to enforce control. The eye in the room. According to witness testimony, cameras were a near constant presence. In homes, in hotels, in hallways, in bedrooms. Jane, a central witness, testified that she was filmed without her consent during multiple freak-offs. Encounters orchestrated by Combs involving drugs, strangers, and sex. She recalled walking into hotel suites only to find hidden cameras already rolling. Sometimes Combs filmed with his own phone. Other times, she says he ordered staff to record from different angles. The lighting wasn't accidental. The setup wasn't spontaneous. This was organized. Jane said, "It got to the point where I didn't know if anything was real anymore. Even when I was alone, I felt watched. The fear didn't end when the session ended. It lingered. Because once the footage existed, so did the threat. Video is blackmail. This is where manipulation sharpens into a weapon." Multiple women testified that they were shown footage of themselves, naked, disoriented, engaging in sex acts they say they never agreed to. Some were high. Others were intoxicated. Many said they had no memory of the event being recorded. In one account, a woman said she was asked to rewatch the video. Not to celebrate, but to correct her behavior. She was allegedly told she looked disinterested, and that next time she'd better perform right. This is video as punishment. Another witness, a former staffer, claimed she overheard Combs referencing tapes in conversations about keeping people in line. While these recordings have not all been submitted as public evidence, the federal investigation includes seizure of phones, hard drives, and surveillance systems from Combs' properties in Los Angeles and Miami. This isn't private kink. This is potentially evidence of criminal intimidation. The legal layer, consent versus coercion. Here's where it gets even more complex. Consent to sex does not equal consent to being filmed. Consent to being filmed does not equal consent to distribution. And in every testimony, the issue isn't whether cameras were visible. It's whether the women ever had the power to say no. Jane says she didn't consent. Cassie says she resisted. Others say they only realized after the fact that they'd been recorded. In a psychological manipulation cycle, recording someone in a vulnerable moment creates a power imbalance that doesn't expire. Even after the abuse ends, the fear of exposure lingers. Victims often stayed, not because they wanted to, but because the footage trapped them. Control through fear of public shame. This is perhaps the most effective form of modern-day control. The threat of going viral. For the women involved with Combs, many were models, performers, dancers, or rising figures in the entertainment world. A leaked video, especially one showing them under the influence, in humiliating positions, or engaged in sex acts with multiple people, would end careers and reputations. They didn't fear prison. They feared public opinion. One woman testified, "He never had to say it. I just knew, if I left, those videos would be the first thing TMZ saw the next morning." That's how psychological captivity works. It makes silence feel like survival. The role of image management. Beyond the camera was the image. Combs didn't just record what happened in private. He managed what the world saw. Instagram posts were curated. Tabloid leaks were blocked. When women showed up at events, it was on brand, the perfect girlfriend, cool ex, new flame. Behind each public photo was allegedly a script, and behind the script, fear. Cassie said she was made to smile in public even after being beaten. Jane said she was told to dress a certain way, walk a certain way, and smile, or risk being replaced. This isn't relationship conflict. It's persona manipulation. The message was clear. You are a prop in my image. And if you break character, there will be consequences. Staff participation or survival. The manipulation didn't stop with the victims. It extended to staff. Assistants, security guards, and drivers were allegedly told not to look too closely, not to ask questions, and in some cases, to help with the filming or setup. Some of them stayed quiet. Others testified that they were threatened. Capricorn Clark said she was kidnapped at gunpoint, accused of leaking information, and held for hours in an undisclosed location. She claimed Combs believed she had video files that could incriminate him, and that he was willing to risk everything to get them back. That's not paranoia. That's enterprise-level threat containment. Whether these staffers were enablers or victims themselves remains legally unresolved. but the pattern is undeniable. A culture of fear sustained the silence. Psychological consequences of being watched. For a woman, being watched without consent is not just a violation of privacy. It is a psychological wound. Survivors of surveillance-based abuse report symptoms that mimic PTSD. Anxiety, dissociation, sleep paralysis, persistent fear that they're being followed, recorded, or exposed. Jane testified, "Even now, years later, I still unplug hotel TVs. I cover laptop cameras. I can't trust the mirror in a dressing room." This is what's known in behavioral psychology as surveillance trauma, a persistent inability to feel safe, even when the threat is gone. And for these women, the trauma didn't begin when the camera clicked. It began when they realized it never stopped. The system of submission. Submission wasn't demanded violently. It was conditioned. Every time a woman complied, she was rewarded. Rent paid. Bags gifted. Trips booked. Smiles captured on social media. Every time she resisted, she was punished. Silence. Humiliation. Threats. Video reminders. This is known as operant conditioning, a system of behavioral manipulation using reward and consequence. Over time, the subject learns not just to obey, but to internalize the obedience. That's how submission becomes self-sustaining. Case precedent. Similar patterns in history. The Diddy case doesn't exist in a vacuum. There are parallels. Harvey Weinstein, R. Kelly, Jeffrey Epstein. In each case, men in power used image, influence, and documentation to maintain control. In each case, victims waited years before speaking. And in each case, silence was the most valuable currency. This case, depending on its outcome, may set legal precedent on how surveillance-based manipulation is prosecuted. But even if the conviction doesn't happen, the cultural shift already has. We are now looking at consent, privacy, and fame through a different lens. The cost of exposure. The cameras captured what they were meant to, bodies. But what they really recorded were broken boundaries, fractured identities, and submission under psychological duress. Every minute of footage, if it exists, is not just a recording. It's a document of fear, of compliance, of a woman robbed of agency. As of now, the investigation includes digital evidence collection from raids on Combs' properties, phones, hard drives, internal surveillance systems. Federal prosecutors are analyzing terabytes of data to determine who was recorded, when, and under what conditions. That evidence may become the backbone of a trafficking case. But more importantly, it may become the truth that validates what so many women have whispered, but were too afraid to say aloud. Until now, a staff built on fear. If manipulation was the foundation of this case, then fear was its infrastructure. In Chapter 4, we step out of the bedroom and into the boardroom, or rather, into the corridors of power surrounding Sean Diddy Combs. Here, we find personal assistants, house managers, drivers, bodyguards, people who didn't live with him, but lived under him. Their proximity didn't grant them protection. It made them vulnerable. Because the Diddy case isn't just about the women he allegedly abused. It's about the system he allegedly built, and the people he allegedly used to maintain it. What emerges is a portrait not of a lone manipulator, but of a workplace culture grounded in silence, compliance, and fear. Controlled workplace culture. Capricorn Clark was not a girlfriend. She was a staff member, part of Combs' inner operations team. And yet, her testimony in 2024 was one of the most disturbing in the case. She alleged that she was kidnapped at gunpoint by associates of Combs in retaliation for suspected leaks about his behavior. Taken to an undisclosed location, interrogated, and released only after assurances that she had kept quiet. The motive, fear that she possessed or had copied videos, the very footage that other women claim were used to trap them. In most corporate environments, whistleblower laws protect employees. But what do you do when your workplace operates like a shadow state? Job descriptions, and what they didn't say. According to former employees and court documents, staff were often given vague or overly broad job roles. Executive assistant, hospitality coordinator, event logistics, talent manager. On paper, it looked like entertainment industry work. But in practice, these roles allegedly included coordinating travel for women involved in freak-offs, delivering packages that may have contained drugs, scheduling parties designed around sexual encounters, setting up security systems with full surveillance capabilities. monitoring phones or social media for potential leaks, enforcing loyalty through intimidation tactics. None of this was in the HR manual, because there was no HR. Coercion within the chain of command. This is where manipulation becomes multi-layered. Employees weren't just passive observers. Some were allegedly instructed to participate in controlling others, driving victims to locations, guarding rooms during encounters, retrieving video footage after the fact. But many say they didn't realize what they were part of until it was too late. One anonymous former driver testified off record that he once picked up a woman from a Beverly Hills hotel. She was crying, wearing only a t-shirt, and said nothing the entire ride. When he mentioned it to a supervisor, he was told, "Don't ask questions. You want to keep your job, right? This is not active complicity. This is institutional gaslighting. A system where workers are trained not to think critically, but to comply quietly. Pay, perks, and pressure." Combs was known to be a generous boss, until he wasn't. Employees received lavish bonuses, expensive gifts, access to elite spaces, and sometimes even cars. But all of it came with a caveat. Loyalty is non-negotiable. Multiple former assistants said that when someone acted disloyal, their paychecks were delayed. Their access cards were shut off. Their names were removed from flight lists or studio clearances. Fear wasn't just theoretical. It had financial teeth. If you worked for Diddy, you didn't just serve a man. You served a brand, a legacy, a regime, the inner circle. There are layers to every powerful man's orbit. And according to federal investigators, Diddy had an inner circle of loyalists, longtime friends, managers, and handlers who allegedly played direct or indirect roles in sustaining the environment of control. Some have been subpoenaed. Others remain unnamed in sealed court documents. But what's clear is that control was not spontaneous. It was delegated. For example, employees allegedly scouted women at clubs or events. Security allegedly helped remove uninvited guests or deter questioning. Assistants allegedly coordinated the arrival and departure of women to avoid public overlap or suspicion. Tech staff allegedly helped preserve and possibly erase sensitive footage. This is not speculative. This is from depositions and law enforcement interviews currently under federal review. It points to a larger problem: the weaponization of loyalty. When loyalty turns to fear. One former bodyguard, speaking anonymously to a journalist under condition of legal protection, described being asked to escort a woman off the property after she allegedly refused a filmed encounter. He says she was hysterical and claimed she was drugged. He was told she was unstable and to get her away from the house. He did, and he never saw her again. He told reporters, "I still think about her, but you don't ask questions around him. You just do the job." That quote cuts to the core of how manipulation flows downward, not just into romantic relationships, but into organizational behavior. The legal implications for staff. Some staff may become witnesses. Others may face charges. The federal government is investigating who knew what and when, and whether any employees knowingly facilitated coercive activities or sex trafficking. Legal experts say the case hinges on three elements. Knowledge. Did staff know these acts were non-consensual? Participation. Did they help orchestrate or conceal the abuse? Benefit. Did they gain materially from the system they helped enforce? This is not just about Combs. It's about the machine that may have been built around him. Culture of compliance. Diddy wasn't the first man in power to surround himself with silence. But what's emerging now is a portrait of a workplace where silence was institutionalized, where assistants were told to delete footage, where staff were instructed to never leave women alone, where security personnel allegedly intimidated victims during or after incidents. Employees were not merely witnesses. They were environmental reinforcers of a culture that allegedly allowed abuse to thrive in plain sight. The human cost to employees. Many former staffers are now experiencing their own psychological fallout. Fear of legal retribution. Fear of professional exile. Some report nightmares, anxiety, and career blacklisting. A few have gone into hiding. And why wouldn't they? Because when your livelihood is tied to protecting a lie, and you don't know what's on those hard drives seized by federal agents, the truth becomes a liability. Even for those who did nothing wrong, proximity has become dangerous. Who's protecting the protectors? This chapter ends not with a verdict, but a question. Who protects the protectors when the power they serve turns into a crime scene? who shields the drivers, the assistants, the interns, the people whose names were never in the press but who saw everything. If the allegations are true, they were both participants and prisoners of a structure bigger than any job description. And now, with subpoenas flying and trials looming, some may become key witnesses. Others may remain silent, not out of loyalty, but out of fear that's never really left them. Love as leverage. They didn't start as victims. Not at first. They started as girlfriends, collaborators, proteges. Some were signed artists. Others were personal companions. All of them were made to feel, at least in the beginning, that they were special, chosen, loved. And that's what makes this chapter so difficult. Because chapter 5 isn't about force. It's about emotional manipulation disguised as love. A dynamic far harder to detect, far harder to prosecute, and far easier for the public to dismiss. But make no mistake, what these women experienced, by their own accounts, was not a relationship. It was a psychological campaign of control, dependency, and trauma bonding. And it all begins with love, the love bombing phase. Almost every survivor described the same entry point: affection, gifts, intimacy. Jane, in her testimony, said the first months with Combs felt like a dream. He bought her jewelry, flew her on private jets, paid her rent. He was attentive, generous, charismatic. He said all the right things. This is a textbook manipulation tactic known as love bombing, an intense period of overwhelming affection designed to build attachment quickly and emotionally disarm the target. For many women, the signs of control didn't appear until they were already financially and emotionally entangled. That's not coincidence. That's strategy. Shifting the balance. Once the affection was secured, the dynamic began to shift. The attention became conditional. Jane said she was told to earn his love. Cassie's lawsuit alleged she was required to perform sexual favors, sometimes involving strangers, in order to prove loyalty. Others said they were ignored or punished if they questioned his requests or expressed discomfort. One woman said, "He'd give you the world, and then take it away in 1 second, just to remind you who gave it to you. This is not love. This is emotional blackmail. Gifting as control. Luxury isn't always a reward. Sometimes it's a leash." Multiple women described being given expensive cars, watches, clothing, rent-free apartments. But every gift came with a silent condition: loyalty. If they disobeyed, or even disagreed, they were reminded of what they had, and who had given it to them. Jane testified. "He'd say, 'You know you'd still be in a one-bedroom if it wasn't for me. You owe me.' This isn't generosity. It's financial dependency disguised as romance. When money becomes emotional currency, freedom becomes a debt you can't repay. The language of control. Emotional manipulation often hides in everyday language. 'I made you. You'd be nothing without me. You think someone else would love you after what we've done. You're lucky I even want you.'" These statements, alleged in multiple testimonies, weren't screamed. They were whispered, delivered casually, and repeated until the women believed them. That's how control is internalized. When the victim begins to doubt her own worth, not just to him, but to the world. This is the power of verbal gaslighting. The slow erosion of a woman's ability to define reality for herself. Isolation through love. Another common tactic: social isolation. Several women said they were discouraged or directly forbidden from seeing family or friends. Cassie claimed she was monitored closely, her movements tracked, her phone checked. Jane said she was discouraged from speaking with her child's father, even when it was related to custody logistics. The justification was always the same: "I just care about you. I'm protecting you." But this is not protection. It's containment. When love becomes the reason for control, manipulation becomes invisible. Trauma bonding. This is where emotional abuse becomes a self-reinforcing system. A woman experiences kindness, followed by cruelty, then kindness again. Each trauma is followed by an apology, a gift, a grand romantic gesture. And over time, the mind begins to tie relief to the abuser. Jane said, "I stayed because I believed if I just did better, he'd be the man I fell in love with again." This is known as trauma bonding, a psychological phenomenon where the victim becomes emotionally attached to their abuser through cycles of abuse and reward. It's not weakness. It's conditioning. Sexual compliance through love. Several survivors stated that sex became a requirement for affection. Not an act of connection, a test of obedience. Jane testified that she was asked to perform with other women while Combs watched. When she resisted, she was accused of not loving him, of being boring, of being disloyal. Cassie alleged similar coercion, that she was instructed to sleep with male sex workers while Diddy watched, and told this was part of what kept their bond unique. These acts were framed as love through sacrifice, but they weren't sacrifices. They were extractions of consent, of dignity, of self-worth. Public love, private control. To the outside world, these women appeared adored, photographed, posted, publicly validated. But multiple survivors claimed that their public displays were forced performances, that they were told what to wear, when to smile, what to post. Cassie said she was told to attend events immediately after incidents of abuse. Jane said she was ordered to write flattering captions under photos of herself and Combs, even during periods when they weren't speaking privately. That's not romance. That's image laundering. And it's a form of emotional gaslighting on a public stage. The cost of leaving. Leaving a manipulative relationship is never simple. For these women, leaving meant losing housing, losing financial stability, losing access to their own children's school funding, risking public exposure through leaked footage, risking career blackballing in an industry Combs dominated. Jane said she didn't leave for over 2 years because she feared becoming homeless and because she was afraid no one would believe her. And for a long time, no one did. The lie of choice. This is the most dangerous myth surrounding this case, that these women chose to stay, that they chose the lifestyle, that they chose to be part of this world. But what we know from decades of research in behavioral psychology is this. Manipulation turns choices into illusions. It replaces agency with survival, and it reframes abuse as love. By the time a woman chooses to comply, her options have already been erased. And that is not a decision. That is submission scripted by fear. Where the court stands, federal prosecutors are presenting these emotional dynamics not as background, but as evidence of intent, of power imbalances, and of a long-running system designed to coerce. Defense attorneys, as expected, argue that these were adult relationships, that these women benefited from the lifestyle, that their participation was consensual. But consent cannot exist in the presence of coercion, fear, and economic dependency. And that is the legal debate now unfolding. A debate that will define not just the future of this case, but how society views manipulation masquerading as love. Systemic silence. In Chapter 6, we step away from the penthouses and hotel rooms. We're not focusing on Diddy. We're focusing on everyone who stayed silent. Because if the allegations are true, if Sean Diddy Combs manipulated, coerced, filmed, assaulted, and trafficked women for years, the next question is obvious. How did he get away with it for so long? And the answer is difficult. He got away with it because he was powerful, but also because he was protected by systems, by silence, by institutions that saw the signs and chose not to act. This chapter is about the bystanders, the beneficiaries, and the brands, and how systemic silence becomes the most powerful form of manipulation of all. Celebrity as camouflage. Sean Combs wasn't just famous. He was respected, a black mogul, a music innovator, a cultural icon. He made hits. He built wealth. He survived Biggie's death, business wars, and decades of industry upheaval. That reputation created armor. Women weren't accusing a man in obscurity. They were accusing a legend, someone whose name paid salaries, filled arenas, and headlined award shows. To question Diddy wasn't just uncomfortable. It was unprofitable. The media's complicity. Cassie's allegations, when they surfaced in 2023, shocked the public. But not everyone. Several journalists, including reporters from Rolling Stone and The Daily Beast, later admitted they had heard whispers for years. Stories shared off the record. Sources who were afraid to go on record. Victims who backed out after receiving legal threats. In some cases, outlets passed on running stories out of fear of litigation. Others were allegedly discouraged by editors who worried about burning bridges with a valuable cultural figure. This is known as editorial suppression, when newsrooms choose silence over risk and allow abusive power structures to remain intact. Manipulation didn't just happen inside relationships. It happened between Diddy and the press. Legal shielding, NDAs, settlements, private investigators. Diddy's legal apparatus was vast and allegedly aggressive. Several women reported receiving cease and desist letters before ever speaking publicly. Some said they were visited by attorneys or security professionals who warned them, subtly or explicitly, to be careful. In Cassie's case, her lawsuit was settled within 24 hours of filing, a timeline virtually unheard of in civil litigation of this scale. While settlements are not admissions of guilt, they do one thing very effectively. They stop the conversation. And in an environment where speaking meant financial ruin, digital humiliation, or legal threats, silence wasn't just a coping mechanism. It was the only option. Industry silence. Several survivors named public figures, executives, and artists who allegedly witnessed abuse, or at least knew of the pattern, and chose not to intervene. Whether out of fear, loyalty, or self-preservation, these individuals became part of what prosecutors now call a protective ecosystem. These were the people who booked him, defended him, aligned with his brand, or simply said nothing when it would have made all the difference. No one is required to be a hero. But silence, especially in the face of trauma, becomes co-signing by default. Brand partnerships. Corporate America played a major role in preserving Diddy's image. Ciroc, Revolt, Sean John, Apple Music, Amazon. He wasn't just a musician, he was a global product. Even after the initial lawsuit from Cassie, many of these brands remained quiet. Few issued statements. None suspended partnerships until the federal raids were conducted months later. Why? Because controversy is bad for business. Because allegations aren't convictions. Because silence is safer than confrontation. But silence in the presence of power is an endorsement of control. The cost of speaking out. The women who did speak, Cassie, Jane, Capricorn Clark, and others, paid a price. They lost jobs, opportunities, relationships. Some were harassed online. Others were accused of being opportunists. At least one reportedly went into hiding after receiving threats. This is not just retaliation. It's the weaponization of public perception, a coordinated manipulation of the court of public opinion. For every survivor who speaks, there are dozens more who never will. Not because they lack evidence, but because they lack protection. Manipulation at scale. This is what systemic manipulation looks like. A woman is abused. She tries to leave. She's reminded of what she'll lose. She's threatened legally, emotionally, or socially. She considers speaking out. She realizes no one will believe her. She stays silent. Repeat. Now add dozens of women. Then add hundreds of people who worked near the abuse. Then add companies, lawyers, brands, and fans. All choosing the comfortable lie over the complicated truth. This isn't just a Diddy problem. It's a systemic failure of accountability. The federal intervention. It wasn't until multiple women filed lawsuits, federal investigators launched formal inquiries, and two properties were raided in early 2025 that the silence finally broke. That silence wasn't passive. It was actively maintained for years. And its collapse marks a new chapter. Not just for Diddy's alleged victims, but for how we as a society begin to process the role of fame in hiding abuse. Because once the illusion is shattered, what remains is far more disturbing. Not just one man, but a system that protected him. The cost of speaking. When a survivor speaks, we often hear the words. What we don't always hear is the cost. In Chapter 7, we examine what it takes, mentally, physically, socially, to come forward against a man with Sean Diddy Combs' reach, money, and cultural influence. Because the manipulation doesn't end when the abuse stops. It continues through the courtroom, through the backlash, through the public judgment, and the internal damage that speaking truth to power almost always brings. This is the cost of testifying. This is the price of breaking silence. And for many of the women in this case, that cost has been staggering. Courtroom trauma. The federal trial has lasted months. Inside the courtroom, survivors like Jane have testified in excruciating detail. Every movement dissected. Every decision questioned. Every moment of fear or confusion treated like an inconsistency. This is what's known as trial re-traumatization. A process where survivors are forced to relive their trauma under cross-examination, often in front of their alleged abuser. Jane spoke for over 3 days. She described being filmed, drugged, coerced, beaten, and then asked by defense attorneys why she didn't leave sooner, why she took gifts, why she smiled in photos. Her voice cracked, her memory blurred. At one point, she asked the court, "Does it make me a liar because I loved him? Because I stayed?" It doesn't. But in the eyes of the system, trauma rarely behaves the way a jury expects it to. public scrutiny, and digital harassment. Once the media picked up the story, the attacks began. Social media platforms became battlegrounds. Survivors were accused of chasing money, clout, or revenge. Some had their pasts dug up, old photos, texts, music videos used to paint them as willing participants. Even anonymous witnesses faced backlash. Screenshots of redacted court documents circulated. Speculative threads tried to unmask accusers. This is digital revictimization, a secondary trauma caused not by the perpetrator, but by the public. And it's a manipulation tactic in itself. When enough people doubt your pain, you start to doubt it too. Physical and mental health fallout. Multiple survivors have reported lasting physical consequences. Chronic migraines, PTSD, substance dependency, dissociation, panic attacks, sleep disorders. In Jane's testimony, she described waking up in the middle of the night to check under her bed, years after her last encounter with Combs. Cassie, in her civil filing, spoke of flashbacks and anxiety that made public appearances unbearable. These are not exaggerations. They are documented trauma symptoms, validated by clinical professionals and consistent with coercive abuse survivors. Manipulation may not leave visible scars, but it reconfigures the nervous system in ways that never fully reset. Professional blacklisting. Several women who came forward were models, dancers, musicians, women who depended on the entertainment industry to survive. By accusing a mogul, they effectively ended any chance of being welcomed back into that ecosystem. One unnamed survivor said she was dropped from a brand campaign just weeks after media coverage linked her to the case. Another said she was warned by a talent agent. If you go public with this, no one will hire you again. Not because of Diddy, but because you'll be a liability. This is the invisible hand of industry silencing. A system where speaking truth comes at the expense of your entire career. The toll on staff and witnesses. It's not just the survivors. Capricorn Clark, a former employee, alleged she was kidnapped and threatened by Combs' team. Since testifying, she's reportedly relocated for safety. At least one former driver involved in the federal inquiry has refused public comment due to fear of retaliation. Some witnesses have described feeling surveilled. Others have reportedly received anonymous messages warning them to stay quiet. This isn't conspiracy. It's ongoing intimidation, and it echoes what many described during their time working for Combs. You can leave, but you'll never really be free. Family strain. Survivors don't suffer alone. Family members have faced death threats, online harassment, and invasive questions from media and strangers. One survivor said her mother's phone number was leaked on social media. Another said her child was approached by a reporter outside their school. This is the collateral damage of accountability. When standing up to power puts not just yourself, but your entire circle, in danger. And yet, they still testified. That tells you something. The system's response. So far, the legal system has not charged Sean Combs with criminal counts stemming directly from witness testimony. The investigation is ongoing. Civil suits have been settled or remain in motion. But the trial, and the public attention it has sparked, has created a precedent. That manipulation, coercion, and emotional domination are now being considered within the framework of accountability. That silence is no longer impenetrable. And that survivors are not just emotional. They are evidentiary. They are facts. They are files. They are proof of something systemic. Why they still came forward. Knowing all of this, the risk, the trauma, the loss, why did they still speak? Because manipulation only survives in darkness. Because their silence once protected their abuser. And breaking that silence is the first act of freedom, even if it costs everything else. Jane said, I thought I was helping him by staying. I thought that's what love was. Now I know it was control. Cassie said she came forward not to relive her pain, but to end the pattern. This is not just about one man. It's about a system. And the only way to dismantle a system is to speak directly into it. The trial isn't over, but the illusion is. The cameras are still rolling. The jury hasn't ruled. The gavel hasn't fallen. The system is still processing testimony, evidence, digital records, cross-examinations, and legal motions. But even as this case winds its way through federal courtrooms, one thing is already over. The illusion of the harmless superstar, the illusion of consensual excess, the illusion that fame, wealth, and legacy exist outside of accountability. because if this case has shown us anything, it's this. Manipulation is not always loud. Sometimes it looks like luxury, and by the time the world sees it, it's already done its damage. The current state of the case. As of now, Sean Diddy Combs is under federal investigation for sex trafficking, racketeering, coercion, witness intimidation, obstruction of justice, transporting individuals across state lines for illegal sexual purposes. Multiple lawsuits have been filed. Some settled. Others remain active. Properties in Los Angeles and Miami have been raided. Hard drives seized. Testimonies recorded. He denies all allegations. He pleads not guilty. But the facts, the patterns, and the testimonies form a consistent narrative, one that the court is now tasked with confirming or disproving. The pattern recognized. This case is not about isolated incidents. It's about a sustained pattern of emotional manipulation, financial dependency, sexual coercion, public gaslighting, media management, surveillance, fear, silence, and it spans over two decades. From Cassie Ventura to Jane to unnamed employees and assistants, the behavior described shows a deliberate system, not spontaneous abuse. This is not about scandal. This is about design, the failure of power structures. In every direction, there were people, institutions, and industries positioned to stop this. And they didn't. Media outlets passed on stories. Brands prioritized image over safety. Executives protected assets. Friends stayed silent. Employees looked the other way. Victims were pressured to stay quiet. The machine around Diddy didn't just amplify his art. It allegedly amplified his abuse. And that is what makes this case so dangerous and so important. Because the culture that protected him is still intact and still capable of shielding others. The role of the court. Legal systems are not built to handle emotional manipulation. They measure bruises, contracts, camera angles, timestamps. They ask victims why they didn't run. They ask survivors why they stayed. They reduce psychological warfare into cross-examinable statements. But this case has forced the courts and the culture to reckon with more. Can manipulation be prosecuted? Can emotional coercion be proven? Can silence, compliance, and love be recontextualized as symptoms of abuse? And more urgently, can a system built to protect men like Sean Combs hold them accountable? If there's a verdict, it may take months. The court will decide whether the evidence proves crimes beyond a reasonable doubt. That's their role. That's their duty. But for the survivors, the women who lived this, the verdict may be secondary. Because by speaking, by testifying, by enduring interrogation and public scrutiny, they already did the hardest thing. They said what no one else would say. They made manipulation visible. They exposed the system. And they broke the illusion. If there isn't, if the jury rules in Combs' favor, if charges are dropped, if cases stall, does that mean it didn't happen? No. It means the standard of proof wasn't met. It means legal thresholds weren't crossed. It doesn't erase the trauma, the patterns, or the corroboration. And it doesn't invalidate the public record. Because the survivors have already shifted the cultural understanding of what abuse can look like in proximity to power. The trial isn't over. But the cultural shift? That's already underway. The broader impact. This case is not just about one man. It's about how society treats women who accuse powerful men. How manipulation is misunderstood, minimized, or romanticized. How money buys silence, and sometimes freedom. How abuse can masquerade as love. How media, law, and branding intersect to protect predators. How survivors reclaim truth by telling it, even when no one wants to hear it. If there's a legacy here, let it be this. Belief is the beginning of justice. Final words. I began this investigation with a simple premise. If this happened, how did no one stop it? Now I understand. They did try to stop it. In text messages that went ignored, in lawsuits that were buried, in relationships that collapsed under the weight of unspoken trauma. But systems are strong. Power is protected. And silence is contagious. Until it isn't. Until someone like Cassie, like Jane, like Capricorn breaks it. And then everything changes. Not immediately. Not in court. But in culture. And in a world that's still learning to recognize manipulation in its most polished forms. That may be the most powerful verdict of all.